So we are starting Perek Gimel today. My hope is to do Perek Gimel in the beginning of Perek Daled. We lost one class because I split one class into two. So this is our last unit or shir on Megillat Ruth before Shavuot. Of course, next week there's no class. But I do have one more shir after this. I'll talk to Torah in Motion. It's a standalone subject, and maybe we can find a time to schedule it. It actually might work before the 3 weeks or something. We'll figure that out. But in the meantime, we're starting with Perek Gimel, and the other shirim from the last 2 weeks have all been posted on the Torah in Motion website. If anybody missed and wants to go back, they are there. Perek Gimel. Vatomer la Naomi chamota, biti, halo avakesh lach manoach asheyitavlach. Naomi, mother-in-law, says to her daughter-in-law, meaning to Ruth, my daughter, I shall seek some kind of peace for you, well-being for you. In other words, I've come up with an idea to help you, to kind of engage you. And actually, I'm going to shift for 1 second. I apologize. I want to try to do it from this this text, which is where we typically read from, just a little easier to read. I need to seek some kind of rest for you that will be good. Bata, hello, Boaz modatanu. Boaz, of whom we spoke last week, the whole shir last week about Boaz in the field. And Naomi's comment last week, in the end of Perek Bet, was to recognize that Boaz was migoalenu, right? That he is from our redeemers. And we'll talk about what the concept of redeemers is in a moment. But he is from our redeemers, from a relative. Ashayit et narotav, the one who with whose maidens you were gleaning. Back to that discussion. Hinehu zore et goren hasorim halayla. Behold, he is winnowing barley in the threshing floor tonight. Now, if you remember everything we said last week about how much of an effort it was to train Ruth in the etiquette of modesty within the fields of Israel. Okay, if you remember, Boaz is trying to gently explain it to her. Naomi tried to gently explain it to her. She finally got it. Okay. This chapter is going to turn everything we learned about the etiquettes of modesty in Israel is going to turn it all upside down. That's what it is. Behold, Boaz is threshing, winnowing in the threshing floor tonight. I'm going to give you a task. You may not understand it, but I'm going to give you a task. Verachatzt, besacht, besamt simlotayich. Wash, anoint, put on your garments, dress yourself up, make yourself pretty. V'yaradit hagoren, and you go down to the threshing floor. Al tivadei le'ish ad kalato lechov lishtot. Don't make yourself known to any man. Meaning, nobody goes to the threshing floor at night to sleep. That's the male domain only. So don't let anybody know. And then in the middle of the night, v'hi b'shachvo, v'yadata et makoma sheyishkav sham, take note of where he lies, of where he goes to sleep, right? You're hiding in the bushes, so to speak, till he goes to sleep. And then, uvat v'gilit margulotav, b'shachavt, go and uncover his feet, and lie down. V'hu yagid lach asher tasin. And then he will instruct you further, which is the most extraordinary euphemism employed in all of Tanakh. You just be there and let him take it from there. Batomer Ela, Ruth says, Kol Asher Tomri Ela, whatever you say, I'll do. I can only imagine in her head what's going through her mind. After everything we'd learned in chapter two, suddenly like, okay, this is the exact opposite of all etiquette of modesty. I'm not even sure she would do this if she was in Moab, let alone in Israel. Vateret agoren, she goes down to the threshing floor. Vatas kechol asher tzivata chamota. She does exactly as her mother-in-law had instructed her. Boaz ate and drank and was in good spirits, and he went to lie at the edge of the grain. So she came in secret, she uncovered his feet, she climbed into the blanket, and there she lay. In the middle of the night, the man trembled, turned around, and there was a woman lying at his feet. We'll get to the Medrash. There's an extraordinary series of Midrashim about this story. We'll get to them in a moment, but I just want to understand what's going on. Vayomer, mi'at, who are you? Now he doesn't recognize her at all because it's the middle of the night, right? Vatomer, anochi Rut amatecha, I am Rut, your handmaid. Ufrasta knafecha al amatecha ki goel ata. Spread forth your garment over your handmaid, for you are our redeemer. That sentence we are going to have to unpack. What exactly is it that she is requesting? It's an interesting phrase because it's very similar to the phrase Boaz used to describe Rut, asher bata lachasot tachat knafav, right? You have come to seek refuge under the wings of God. And here she says, okay, now you take your garment and spread it over me. Ufrasta knafecha al amatecha. Because you are our Redeemer. What's the connection? Vayomer, and Boaz's response, you understand, I don't think I need to spell it out. You understand what she's asking for? You understand what she's asking him to do? She's asking him to sleep with her. Right? In modern parlance, we would say, okay, sleep with me. But that's a language that Tanakh wouldn't dare use, except maybe Eshet Potiphar, who says to Yosef, shichvimi. Right? In normal etiquette and modesty, the euphemism, the lashon nekiyah of Tanakh wouldn't allow for such a thing. So she it's couched in euphemistic language, but that's essentially what she asks for. And he says yes and no. Meaning, first he blesses her for the initiative, which is really extraordinary. Brucha at la Hashem biti. You are blessed to God. This kindness is even more significant than your first kindness. Why is this an act of chesed? We need to understand. What is the chesed here? Okay, but we'll see what it is. That you didn't go pursue other young men, be they rich or poor, but rather you came to me. Don't be afraid. I'll do exactly what you say. However, no, everybody knows that you are a woman of valor. This was a phrase, by the way, that I had wanted to explore a couple of weeks ago in the Shir on conversion, which we didn't get to. If you read chapter 31, the last chapter of Mishle, and the chapter of Eshet Chayil, the reference there to Sha'ar and Eshet Chayil, right? The notion here is that there's a direct link, and so it's a very powerful connection. Again, I reference it. You can explore it on your own. But know that the true, while I am a redeemer, there is a redeemer closer than me. Therefore, you stay the night, meaning not that he slept with her, he did not sleep with her at night that night, that's clear. But rather, he doesn't want her leaving in the middle of the night because he doesn't want it known that she came to the threshing floor. Right? If he redeems, great. If he doesn't redeem, then I will redeem. And we're going to talk about this phrase, redemption, in a moment. She lay there until the morning and then rose to leave. And he said, do not let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. Vayomer havia mitpachat asher alayich v'achaziva, take, bring your garment, and I will place into it 6 measures of barley, v'yamot shesh sa'orim v'yashet aleh v'yavo ha'ir, so that Naomi knows that she had come and that she was successful in her mission. V'tavol chamotah v'tomeh mi'at biti v'tageid la t'asher kol asher asa la ha'ir, she explained all that Boaz had said. He gave me these 6 measures of barley, so he said, "Don't come empty-handed." And that was a way of communicating that I'm on it. Let's wait it out because this will be resolved by today. He won't let it go past today. Then, of course, chapter 4, which is conversation between Boaz and Ploni Almoni at the gate, that we will, if we have time today, we'll get to and talk about as well. One of the strangest, oddest chapters in all of Tanakh. I called it Redemption and Immorality Explaining the Inexplicable. It's just every sensitivity that we have in the context of Tanakh and the morality and the etiquette of Israel upside down and in reverse. Naomi sends Ruth to the field to solicit Boaz. Ruth comes to the field. She solicits him. He says, "Fine, this is an act of chesed. I will redeem you, but there's somebody else who has first rights of refusal, so let's wait, and then we'll see what's going on." She solicited him. I don't know how somebody else came into the picture. What is going on? And on top of everything else, the notion that she goes to the field to solicit him, and it's just so antithetical to the character and to the theme of modesty and etiquette in Tanakh that it really needs to be unpacked. Chazal take this even further. It's one of those examples where Chazal take what would otherwise be a relatively straightforward and even, I would say, innocent encounter and turn it literally into the most non-innocent encounter you can imagine. Right? In the Pshat, literally, she goes to the field, she lays by his feet, she says, essentially, marry me, which is another way of saying, spread your garment over your maidservant, which is essentially a euphemistic way of saying, marry me because you are a redeemer. And he says, there's somebody else in line first. Let's wait. So she asks him and he says, no, essentially. Chazal go out of their way to describe this word, vayilafet, which means that he turned or he became frightened. And they go, I'm not even going to read the Midrashim because it's just too much. You have it in the source pages that his flesh became hardened, almost a description of having an erection. In Rus Rabosh, there's a description about how he started to stroke her hair and said, "What are you? Are you a spirit? Spirits don't have hair. What are you? Are you a woman? Okay. If you're a woman, are you pure?" She says, "Yes, I'm pure." And then he doesn't touch her because he says, "There's somebody else first," and then comes along the end of the Medrash, Amar Rav Achya, and says, "Avurim ha-Rishayim, cursed are the wicked," referring to Eshet Potiphar. Why? Because Eshet Potiphar grabbed Yosef by the garment, vaseu bivigdo, and said to him in words that are only a Gentile king or queen would articulate in the language of Tanakh, right? Israelite, the Torah would not speak in this language. She says, "Shichmai me, lie with me. But here, ufarastak nafecha lamatecha, she says, "Spread your canopy of your garment over me," and she uses euphemistic language. But at the end of the day, the text was very clear that he didn't touch her. He said to her, "I am one of your redeemers, and I'll do it if I can, but there's somebody else in line first." And how that line works, we need to understand. So I come back to the basic question, what is going on in this text, and why is this kind of a theme? Chazal go out of the way to turn it into an extreme, but at the end of the day, the question remains, what is it about this story that after all of the effort to teach her basic elements of modesty and etiquette, Naomi says to her, go down to the threshing floor where only men are allowed and lie at his feet, and then he'll instruct you further. And she spells it out, marry me. And he says, maybe. It's like the whole thing is so backwards. And it has been pointed out, it has been said, that you can actually trace the lineage of this entire household to these kinds of immoral, illicit moments in history. Not a surprise, right? You have the story of Lot and her and his daughters, from which Moab is born. Right? That's a similar kind of very almost immoral and strange activity. And then you have the story of Yehuda and Tamar. And Tamar, who dresses up as a harlot, is a prostitute in order to seduce Yehuda because she was promised to Shelah. It's just, you'll forgive me, but it's a mess. So we need to sort.
Why is it a mess? Why is it a mess? It means, you know, like if you compare the two stories, you know, and she did like Tamar or she did, you know, with the Naomi's manipulation or whatever she did there, but he resisted. He didn't behave, not like Lot, and not like.
I still don't.
You know, he comes out as a great guy. He didn't touch her. He didn't do anything.
If you can just hold for one moment, I still don't think that's the message of the story. I don't think the message of the story is to highlight how great the guy Boaz was. I think the issue of Megillat Ruth is to highlight how great Ruth is, and Boaz along the way. But nonetheless, I think we have a pattern of events between Lot and his daughters, Yehuda and Tamar, and Boaz and Ruth and Boaz in the field. And the Armafarshim said that he did lie with her. I'm not going to go there because I don't think it's necessary. But at the end of the day, I need to understand what's going on here. And
the women had to take over because the men didn't do their job.
Hang on one second. I have very limited time today. I apologize. I'm going to have to hold questions either to the chat or afterwards. I apologize. There are moments in my thought of trend of thought, which I'll stop and I'll open for questions. But if you could just hold for one moment. So this pattern of this triangle of these three events, Lot and his daughters, Yehuda and Tamar, Ruth and Boaz, has often been identified as a kind of a triangle of events that all follow a same pattern of a kind of a, almost, to use a term that I don't like to use here, but a kind of a, almost snoot, almost kind of a immoral type of behavior. Tamar is a harlot and Lot's daughters from him. And then Ruth solicits Boaz, whether or not he acknowledges it or does something. Something's going on here, and why this is all connected. Davka to David HaMelech. Remember, the Megillah ends with the birth of David. If we go back to the end of the Megillah, chapter 4, we all know the end of the Megillah. Who have the birth of Peretz, the birth of Oved, who have Yishai, have David. Ruth is the mother of Oved, who is the grandfather of David, which means Ruth is David's great-great-grandmother. So, how does this interface with the story of David? So, the story of David, unfortunately, is that last piece of this unit, which we're going to have to delay for another year. But I'm trying to understand the whole picture. And there are those who say that, in fact, that is how the story of David's household had to be created. There was sort of this mystical, esoteric notion of nitzotzot, that from the darkness came light, and from the moments of zenut, you have to have a kind of and there's all kinds of approaches to this in the language, literature of esoteric and more mystical side of things. I'm not sure I'm comfortable with it and understand it, but I think there's a simple way to process through this story as well as the other two. In other words, at the end of the day, whatever I do here, I need to recognize there's a pattern that links this story to Yehuda and Tamar. Clearly, by Yehuda and Tamar, the story is connected at the end of the chapter, the end of the book. Right? When after they marry and the blessing is given to them, by the men of the city, and they say to Boaz that, May God make this household and this woman to you like Rachel and Leah, which is a way of acknowledging what we talked about last week, the Moav equation. And may your house be like the house of Peretz, born to Yudah and Tamar. So clearly there is an acknowledgement that there's a Tamar Yehuda story connection to Ruth as well. Add the Moabite equation, and suddenly you have a triangle that needs to be understood in this context. And I think that that triangle, and we've talked about this in previous shiurim, but in this particular case, that triangle helps us sort out the core issue here, which is that under any other circumstances, what in the value system of Tanakh, what Ruth did would have been unthinkable and considered immoral. In any other moment in Tanakh, a normal routine of Tanakh, what Ruth did was to solicit Boaz and ask him to sleep with her in the field. That would have been an extraordinarily immoral moment. But in this particular case, not only is it not immoral, it's actually expected of her, because what's going on, what's underlying this story, Yud and Tamar, and I'll argue Lot and his daughters as well, is simply the etiquette of the mitzvah of Yibum in its complexity, meaning. We talked about the three that which anchors all three of these stories is the sort of the moral obligation of Yibum, not the halachic or legal obligation of Yibum, but the moral one, the broader expanse. If there's no brother to the other relatives to step into the obligation of Yibum, that I shared with you a couple of weeks ago is based on the Ramban, who argues, Ramban at the beginning of Breishit, that argues that Yud and Tamar is a case of Yibum, Ruth is a case of Yibum. We added Lot and his daughters as well for reasons we'll come to in a second. And Ramban says the idea was that after Matan Torah, if there's no brother, then an immediate relative can't do the mitzvah of Yibum, a prohibited relation. Normally, Yibum would be, pre-Matan Torah, Yibum would have been performed by whoever was closest in line to the deceased husband, even if they were a parent. Meaning, the Yibum by in and of itself challenges or uproots all of the laws of Gilui Arayot, the forbidden relations, because it says here's a forbidden relation that's mandated by the protocols and etiquette of Yibum. The Torah limited that allowance to the brother only. Chazal came along and said, if there's no brother, then as long as there's an expanded, a first cousin, a second cousin, a third cousin, somebody who's permissible from an Arayas perspective, b'chol yorshei hanachla, they would be in line to perform the mitzvah of Yibum, as long as there's no prohibition of forbidden relations. And more importantly, they called this mitzvah Geula. In order to distinguish it from the mitzvah of Yibum, they reframed the name of this mitzvah. So if it's not with a brother, it's not called Yibum anymore, it's called Geula of the deceased husband, of the woman, of the land, of what we'll see in a moment. And then he says, then that's the whole story of Boaz. That this is a story of Geula. And we'll see that in the text. It's very clear that the story is of Geula. That's what Ruth says, Naomi says of Boaz, Migoaleinuhu, that he is of our redeemers. And Boaz himself says to Ruth, that indeed I am a redeemer, ki goel anochi, right? Not a Yibum, but there is a geula concept here, and that yesh goel koav mimenu, but there's a relative in line first. And all of these are cases of, in that regard, what links them is not so much the concept of znut, but more importantly, what links them is the concept of Yibum. How Yibum why Yibam is always in this kind of odd fashion, we'll see momentarily. But come to the story of Yibam itself, and you can see the theme that links all three of these moments through the language of the mitzvah of Yibam. We'll come to Gula a second, but if we go back to the Torah and the Torah's definition of the mitzvah of Yibum, I'll make sure that I haven't lost my place. Okay, I missed one medrash, which it's okay. I'll leave it for now. Here, Dvarim Chafei Pasukei, Ki Yeshu Achim Yachdav Umet Achad Mem Uben En Lov. Brothers were alive at the same time. One dies without any children, without a son. Lo Tiye Eishet Hamet Hachutza LeIsh Zeh. She cannot be go and just go out to another, she's a widow, but she can't go out, or should not go out and marry outside to the relationship, outside of the family. Rather, her husband's brother shall take her and take him as a wife. The first child born shall be one who will establish the name of the brother who is deceased, so that his name not be blotted out of Israel. This notion that somehow, the Ramban describes it in esoteric, philosophical level, that somehow the seed born to this union of the brother and the sister-in-law, that union produces a child who is who represents the deceased husband. And more importantly, for our purposes, she is the one who demands this relationship. She brings him up up to the gate, and she says, "My brother-in-law refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. And so they call the brother in, they push, pressure him, and he refuses, and they have to shame him into trying to do it. Why? Because he has refused to establish the name of the deceased brother. It's a fascinating machloket that we've shown in Rashi and Ramban. According to Rashi, literally means you have to name the child after the deceased husband. Ramban says that's ridiculous. What it means, and there's no case precedent for that. But what it means is that there's on some esoteric spiritual level, the child represents the deceased brother's children. And this notion that to refuse to do so is to refuse to establish the name of the deceased husband, meaning that you will allow his name to be eradicated, that's precisely how Yibum is perceived in all three of these instances. In all three of these instances, the notion of Yibum is exactly this idea, yakum al shem achiv hamet. Or, in the language of Megillat Rut, let's look at Rut first. In the language of Megillat Rut, let's look at Perek Dalet. I'm going to read the rest of this Perek in a second, but I want to pick up one thing in a moment. Vayomer Boaz, when he offers this Ploni Almoni, this other redeemer, other cousin, the opportunity to redeem the field. Actually, let's read it from the beginning. Boaz went up to the gate and he sat there and he said to Ploni Almoni, Sura Shvu Ploni Almoni, come sit here. And he sat there. He took 10 people. Okay, there's that word again. Chalkat asada shelachinu l'alimelech. Machra Naomi ha'shavah mishdei Moav. Remember that field that Naomi sold? Well, it's time to redeem that field. Ani amarti egleoz nechale mokne neged hayoshvim neged ziknei ami. I'm offering you now to, in front of the entire community, redeem that field. Imti gal gal. If you will redeem it, great. Im lo yigal. And if you won't redeem it, let me know and I'll redeem it. Boaz said, fine. Sorry, plenty of money said, and I'll be happy to redeem the field. Until Boaz then told him, Boaz, when you buy the field back for Naomi, you've also acquired Rut the Moabite as a wife, the wife of the deceased husband. Lakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato. That's exactly the mitzvah of Yibum. The mitzvah of Yibum is the mitzvah of Yibum is that the child who will be born, Yakum al Shem Achiv Hamet, will establish the name of the deceased brother. That's precisely what Boaz says to Plony Almoni, Lakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato. To which he responds and says, oh, Adkan, that I'm not prepared to do. Vayomer agolo chaligoli pen ashchit et nachalati, lest I destroy my inheritance. He's not talking about losing his inheritance on the stock market. He's talking about lest I disqualify my own seed, lest I destroy my line, my own line, by accepting, by taking rutamovia. We'll talk, and we'll get to that, his refusal. But the notion that Kim Shem HaMet al Nachlato is the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Yibum, in contrast to the lack of fulfillment, which is considered to destroy an ashchidit nachlati, that should remind us right away of the language of the story of Yudan Tamar. Because by Yudan Tamar, if I just scroll down here for a moment, yeah, that's the phrase by that we just looked at in Perek Dalet Avot, Pen Ashchit et Nachalati. One is the story of Yehuda. Yehuda, the older brother, heir, dies. Vayomer Yehuda le'onan, bo'al eshet achicha, take your sister-in-law, v'yabemota, v'hakem zera le'achicha, establish seed for your brother. That's exactly the mitzvah of Yibum. Vayeda Onan kilo lo yezara. Onan understood that the seed was not to be his, that the seed would not be considered his. It would be on the brother's name and the brother's spiritual legacy, whatever you want to call it. Right? There was a stigma to this mitzvah of Yibum. And therefore, Vayayim Baal Eshet Achiv v'shichet arza. And ashchit et nachalati, the same language. Right? He refused to give seed to his brother. And that was considered an immoral act. Mitzvah was a moral, Yibum was a moral obligation. And to refuse it was to be considered immoral. Lakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato, to establish the name of the deceased on its inheritance, in its portion or in its legacy. And that's precisely what we said connected these two stories to the third in the triangle, namely Lot and his daughters. Because we said Lot and his daughters was also a case of Yibum, albeit not in the legal sense, brother to brother, but in the broader philosophical, moral sense, the daughters thought that there was nothing left to the Sodom and Amor, to the five cities of Sodom that were destroyed, and therefore their goal was not just to establish human, reestablish humankind. I don't think they doubted for a moment. I don't think they thought that humankind was destroyed. I think they understood that the five cities of stone were destroyed. And their goal was, Lakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato. How do they name, how do the daughters name the two children born to Lot? Moav, Minav, and Amon, Ami, my people. Right? Their goal was to perpetuate their people, which was Sodom, and in the persona of Ammon and Moab, somehow to continue to live the legacy of the Nachla, of the inheritance that was destroyed. The mitzvah, the concept, not the mitzvah, but the moral concept that links these three stories are all connected through this concept of Yibum. Now, why is that significant? Because Yibum in and of itself is a mitzvah which is almost a form of znut. Remember that Yibum by, in any other context, a brother-in-law, sister-in-law union is a forbidden relation. The child of that union would be considered a mamzer. And yet the Torah mandates it and the moral obligation of it because of the unique circumstance of the obligation to continue the legacy and to provide, right? There's a purpose to marriage. The purpose of marriage is to provide children to a continuation of a union, continuation of a legacy and of a family. And if the husband dies without children, then that obligation is still unfulfilled. And therefore there's a moral obligation to that original union to find a way to perpetuate the seed and to continue it. The Torah's concept, the philosophical concept of that, was called Yibum or Geula. But here's the key question. On whom does the moral obligation of Yibum rest? That's the key question. Who carries that obligation? And what you have in the story of Yibum is an exact reversal of all the laws of etiquette and morality that are norms in the biblical context. If you go back to the Psukim in Tvarim and watch carefully the role that she plays, that the wife plays in this story. She may not marry outside to a stranger. The Yavam has to marry her. And if he refuses, and then the firstborn would be considered for the brother's line. And if he refuses, so she goes up to the gate, to the zkenim, to the elders, to the Beit Din. She convenes the Beit Din. She proclaims, Me'ein yivami la'akim la'achiv shem b'Yisrael, my brother-in-law has refused to fulfill this obligation to establish a name for his brother in Israel. Lo aval yibmi refuses. Then they'll call him over and then they'll ask him, is that true? And he'll say yes. And then there's a whole ceremony and then she has to publicly shame him, and then she proclaims, "Kacha yaseh le'ish asher lo yivnet beit achiv." This is what has to happen to the person who will not build his brother's house. Yeah, you have to understand. Chas v'shalom, couple gets divorced. How does the divorce process happen in Israel? Who initiates the divorce? The husband. Who hands the divorce to the wife? The husband. In the act of chalitza, which is a reversal, right? It's a kind of a divorce from the obligation of Yibum. Who initiates that divorce? The wife. Who invites, who summons the brother to the Beit Din? The wife. Who does the act of removing the shoe, spitting in the face, saying, making the proclamation, etc.? She does. It's a reversal of the entire role of male and female in all aspects of marriage. The protocols of the etiquette protocols in Tanakh and in Halacha are very unidirectional because of the concept of the Jewish concept of modesty. Yibum reverses every dimension of that protocol. It is her moral obligation. It is her obligation to her first husband, her obligation to the land, her obligation to the seed, her obligation to invite the Yavam to the Goel. That's exactly what Ruth does. She invites the Goel. She invites Boaz to make this union with her. So just understand, why is it about coming into the Goren? Because, how do I put this delicately? In marriage, there's a kedusha, there's an entire ceremony. He has to provide, he has to give her a kesef kedushin, he has to give her some sort of a transactional amount of finances. There's a ketubah, there's all kinds of routines, all kinds of protocols to how marriage is done. In a context in which a brother-in-law or any relative was willing to do the mitzvah of Yibum, what was the marriage ceremony required for Yibum? We do chalitza today. What was the marriage ceremony required for Yibum?
Technically, it's just sleeping with her.
Correct. There is no marriage ceremony. The marriage ceremony is the same marriage ceremony of the original union in the first place. The kesef kedushin was the original money that was given at the time of the first union. He simply goes and he sleeps with her. That's the way the mitzvah of Yibum is fulfilled. Because he's stepping into that role of the deceased husband. And so when she goes to the field and she says, sleep with me, more or less, is what she says to him, she's doing so from the perspective of the fulfillment of the mitzvah, the mandate, the moral obligation of Yibum, and says to her, to Boaz, you are Migoalena, you are from that Redeemer. So will you fulfill the mitzvah of Yibum? And if he would have said yes, if he was next in line, he could have simply taken her that night and the story would have been over. The problem was that Boaz faced was that he wasn't next in line. And so he has to move forward carefully to make sure that there's somebody else who's in line first and give him that option. But that's precisely what's going on in the field. When she goes down to the field and Naomi says to her, just go down to the field and he'll tell you what to do. Meaning they're fully anticipating that the mitzvah of Yibum would have been fulfilled and Yibum would have been consummated at that moment. Boaz put the brakes on it because there's somebody else in line. But that's precisely what Boaz refers to when he says, "Bruchat l'Hashem biti etavt chazdecha acharon min harishon levoti lechat acharei bacharim." This kindness you have shown is better than your first. What kindness? She went down to the field to solicit him in the middle of the night? That's chesed? Yes. Because that's the obligation of Yibum, and the obligation, the moral obligation of Yibum in Megillat Rut is called Chesed. I want to take this one step further. Here's a fascinating chapter in Yirmiyahu. I'll get to Yirmiyahu.
How did Boaz know there was somebody else in line, but Naomi didn't? Because why would Naomi have sent Ruth to Boaz if there was somebody else in line?
I'm not sure that either. I don't know the answer to that question. Either she didn't know. It's possible. Or she didn't care. I mean, not everybody knew all the nuances. He was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was a member of the Sha'ar. He was a member of the court. He knew the rules and the protocols. Maybe Naomi didn't. Maybe Naomi just said, oh, he's Migoalenuhu. He's from our Redeemer. Modatenu. He's from our relations. Oh, great. And he said to her, okay, but there's somebody else in line, so we have to take care of that first. So it's quite possible that Naomi was not acting within the context of the legal framework of the issue, but more of a philosophical framework. Right? I need somebody, and he's willing to do it, and he's been so kind to you, and he's the only person in all of Bet Lechem who's willing to recognize you because you're a Moabite. Let's, you know, take our chances. That's also possible. It's also possible Naomi doesn't say, it's also possible, don't forget, Naomi doesn't say to Ruth, go and sleep with him. Naomi says to Ruth, go down and he'll tell you what to do. It is Ruth who initiates that famous comment of Ufurastak Nefech Alamatech.
How would Ruth know that? She was like not from there. I mean, she was a foreigner. She wouldn't know that.
Okay, but at this point, we're now several months, if not years, into the story, and months, certainly. And I think that's when he... But don't forget, Yibum or Geula, in its context, is a broad societal norm that we talked about when we talked about Lot and his daughters. And Yudah and Tamar too. It predates Matan Torah as a concept, as a norm in society. It's not a Jewish concept. All the Torah did was limited. All right, let me just move on to the next issue for a second. All of this with regards to Yibum as a reflection of the initiative of the woman in the union. That's what makes it unique, and that's what makes it so odd in the context of Tanakh. Tamar who solicits Yudah, Lot's daughters who solicit Lot, and Ruth who solicits Boaz. I would go one step further. There's another element that connects them all. Same idea. Take a look at this passage in Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyahu is talking, it's a famous parak of Yirmiyahu, Yirmiyahu Laman Aleph. We read his Haftar of Rosh Hashanah, and it's a beautiful parak on so many levels. Rachel Mavakal. But now, all right. I'm going to skip much of this beginning. There's a story of Rachel Mavakal, but now crying for her children. There'll be hope. Your children will return to their land. That's how the first part of this Nevuah starts. And then we get to the following description. Haben Yakir Li Ephraim. Isn't Ephraim my dear son? God speaking through Yirmiyahu, God is speaking of Ephraim, the northern kingdom. Yeled Shashuim, my dear child. Kimide Dabribo, as I just speak of him. Remember, he's in exile. Ephraim has gone into exile. Ephraim has gone into the northern kingdom. The northern kingdom has been destroyed. Years of Yirmiyahu, a few years before the destruction of the second temple, of the first temple. I speak him of him and I yearn for him. I'll have mercy on him. Now this is what Yirmiyahu says to the people of Ephraim. Hatzivilach tziyunim, simulach tamrurim. Set up road signs, make guideposts, know how to come back. Shiti libech lemesila derech halacht. Set markers along the highway so that as you leave, you know the way home. Shuvi betulat Yisrael, shuvi el arayich ele. Return, my daughter of Israel, return to these cities. Ad matai titchamakina batashuviveh. How long will you continue to rebel, backsliding daughter? It's time to return home. Correct? Now look at the next line. Ki vara Hashem chadasha ba'aretz. God has created something new in the world. Nikeva tisovev gaver. A woman shall chase and pursue the man. How does that context fit into this prophecy? This is what they will once again say as the people of Judah return to their land. Blessed are you, habitation of God, of righteousness, mountain of holiness, and Israel and Judah shall dwell therein, etc. What's that all about? And the answer in the context of Yirmiyahu is it's a metaphor for what? For there's only one context in Jewish thought in which the woman pursues the man. Namely?
Yibum.
But take Yibum out of its legal framework of the brother-in-law and into the broader framework of the philosophical context of any relative redeeming the wife or the family, and you have not the mitzvah of Yibum, but you have the mitzvah of
Ge'ulah.
And suddenly there's a whole new canvas to this discussion. Because we're no longer talking about Yibum, we're talking about Ge'ulah. And that's precisely the language of Megillat Rut. Ge'ulah is a much bigger concept. Much broader concept. And I want to explore the concept of Geula in Megillat Rut and how it connects to Yirmiyahu. This is exactly what Yirmiyahu is saying. Yirmiyahu is saying that in the context of Geula, as the nation of Israel returns to its land, we typically think of Geula as a national experience, a national process. We return the people to their land. But he pulls in that model the concept of a Yibum / Geula concept of Nekeva to Seviv Gaveh. Right. And that's precisely what Boaz says in his conversation with Ruth. He constantly refers to this as an act of Geula. Look how many times he uses the phrase. When he's talking to Ruth in the field, Atal nam ki goel anochi. I am, in fact, your redeemer. But there's a redeemer closer than me. Stay here at night. If he redeems, great. So be it, he'll redeem. If not, if he doesn't want to redeem you, they're also referring to Yibum, right? Then I will redeem you. And then as he sits down at the shahr, at the gate of the city, and he calls everybody over, Vayomer Lagoel, he says to the Redeemer, this field that belongs to Naomi, you are in line to redeem it. Im tigal gaal, im lo yigal agidale. If you redeem it, great. If not, tell me. Vayomer Nochi Yagal, he says, I'll redeem it. And then he throws on, oh, you want to redeem the land? Guess what? You also get to Lakim Shem Hameta Nachalato. With the land comes the inheritance and the line and the lineage and the family and the people. It's not just about a land. It's about a people. It's about a line. It's about a lineage. It's about Lakim Shem Hamet on Nachalato. So that he says, that he refuses. And this is Galata. You want to do it? Fine. You redeem it. But look how many times he uses the word Goel. This is not about Yibum, it's about Geula. It's about redeeming the land, but the land by itself is only part of the picture. To redeem land, to buy back land is one thing. But it's not about buying back land, it's about reestablishing a connection between the land and its lineage, its family, its people. Lakim Shem Hamet al Nachalato. You know, the very first time the word geula is used in this context, the redemption of land, redemption not of people, but the redemption of land. If you look at the word geula as it appears in Chumash, I just did a quick search. Fascinating. I'm jumping to the end of the source page. I did the matter of what, I apologize for that.
I think daughters.
Excuse me?
With the five daughters.
Earlier.
Chumash.
Earlier.
It's earlier than that?
It's earlier than that. I'll show you in a moment. In Breishit, first of all, Breishit Memchet, Yaakov talks about the angel who redeemed me from evil, which is basically a way of protecting me. So that's a different application. In Shemot Perek Vav, you have the redemption of a people, v'ga'alti etchem. But the first time it's applied to land is in Vayikra Perek Chavhei, in the Parsha of Bahar, in the midst of Yovel. And the mitzvah of Yovel was to return the land to its ancestral ownership. You can't sell the land for eternity. You are like Gever Toshav. You are my people. This land belongs to me, and I'm putting you here as tenants. You will give geula to the land of your inheritance, meaning if you sell the land, you sell it to the Yovel, and the Yovel goes back to the ancestral ownership. And if you don't sell the land, if you sell the land, you have an opportunity to buy it back. That's what the term geula comes from, to buy back the land. But it's not just to buy back the land so you can throw it into the hands of the government. It's to buy back the land and to reconnect the land with its people. With its nachla, with its lakim shem hamet al nachalato, to reestablish the legacy of the deceased family on its ancestral land. Hence, the mitzvah of geula / yibum requires the widow to say there's an obligation to the family, to the land, to the people. I have that obligation because this was my family. I had no children. And so she demands of the deceased, of the brother. She demands of the father-in-law. She of Yehuda. She demands of Boaz. She initiates. And that's what defines each of these events.
Question.
If it's brief, then I'll take a longer question at the end.
The child that's born through Yibum is the one who gets the land?
Yeah, the land goes back. The land, the idea of Yibum is that it reestablished the land and the lineage of the original family.
So that child is the only one that's going to Yashin.
That family, not in the tribe, but the family,
the
yes.
The first child.
Correct.
That's born through Yibum.
Yes.
Or does it go back to the husband?
It goes back to the husband.
To the new husband.
No, the old husband.
The old husband.
The deceased husband. That's the whole point. The whole concept of Yibum and of Geula was to reconnect the family lineage that was in jeopardy of being lost with the land of Israel, which has a connection, right? There's a triangle there between God, the land, and the people. But the idea of Yibum as the idea of Geula as it appears in the Torah, in the mitzvah of Yovel, was that you wanted to keep the people and the land connected. What's exile? And when Yirmiyahu talks about Geula, he's talking about Geula because he's talking about the need to return the people who have been exiled to the land. Right? That's what.
You're claiming that the main thing of this Megillah.
Hang on a second. Let me finish one concept. Right? The main idea of exile was the people exiled from their land, the Galut. And so Geula was to bring them back. But in that context, who's the female? The people of Israel. They're the female. They're the ones who have to initiate that process. Nekevatus of Evgaber. That's why Yirmiyahu says to Israel, make signposts, know your way home. Don't wait for me. You have to return. Shuvi betulat Yisrael. What are you waiting for? Says Yirmiyahu to the people. And he's talking to the northern tribes of Israel. He's saying, make signposts, know how to come home. Shuvi betulat Yisrael. How long are you going to wait? The Geula, by definition, is a new kind of formula. It's not God who redeems you from the land of Egypt and God who brings you to the land of Israel and God who fights your battles and God. No, it's on the contrary. The process is now reversed. You, as the people, have to return home. You are the Knesset Yisrael, is the female in the model, in the metaphor of the relationship with God. And so you have to return to the land. That's precisely what Yirmiyahu says to the people. That's why it's a Geula concept, right? Okay, one step further. With this, I'll conclude, but we'll take it one step further. This is exactly the message of Yechezkel. Yechezkel says the same thing, and he says it much more dramatically. Because Yechezkel says, okay, here you have a land, and here you have a people. But now let's take the metaphor of the Geula metaphor, the Yibum metaphor, and let's take it to the end. Who's deceased? Who's deceased? Now, in light of this discussion, go back and reread the story of the Valley of the Dry Bones in Yechezkel's vision. When he says, he comes out and he sees a valley of all these dead bones. And he says, and God says to him, in Yechezkel, can these bones relive? And Yechezkel says, I have no idea. And he says, prophesy over them. I'm not going to read the whole beginning of it because it's not our, you know the story. We read it as Haftarah on Pesach. And then he gets to the Nimshal. And what's the Nimshal? Vayomer Elai Ben Adam. Ha'atzamot ha'ela. These bones? Kol Beit Yisrael Hema. They are the household of Israel. Who in their exile have said, our hope is lost, our bones are dried up, and we are dead, we are gone, we are in the grave. Meaning, who is the deceased in this metaphor? Right? Who is the deceased? Israel. The Jewish people are deceased. They're in exile. The land is destroyed, the people are in exile. The people are saying, the Jewish nation of Israel is done. It's over. And therefore, God says to them, I will open up your graves. I will cause your graves to come alive. I will bring you back to the land. And then what happens is this nevuah begins to take place. And the bones begin to come together and sinews begin to come on them, and there's a great wind that goes into them, and they stand on their feet, etc. And as they stand on their feet, what happens to them? bina beit dikashet zivani v'tavo behem ruach v'yichyu v'yamdu al raglehem chayil kaved me'od. A great army of Israel emerges from that moment. The whole prophecy of the Atzamot Yiveshot, of the dry bones, was to follow up on Yahweh's message, was exactly the same idea. Israel thinks that they have died in the moment of exile and destruction. And so the moment of redemption, of Geula, is the moment where they realize that there's still hope, that they're still alive, that they're still great, that they can still come back to life. And what will happen to them? Where will they go?
To the land.
El Admat Yisrael. They will come back to the land. Or, in the language of the Mitzvah of Yibum, and in the language that we have been discussing, Lakim Shem Hamet Al Nachalato, to reestablish the deceased upon its inheritance. That is precisely what Geula is. It's to reestablish the nation of Israel that has perceived itself as been exiled and therefore died in almost a kind of a triat ametim. And now the next generation that has been revived returns to her land. Knesset Yisrael akim shem emet anachalato. Says Yirmiyahu, hineni barati chadash ba'aretz. Nekivato sovev gavet. This is all new. The female will initiate. The people will return home. And the people will return to their land. So I come back to the story of Ruth. And if I pull the pieces of the story together, the mitzvah, it's not an accident that the mitzvah of Yibum, when it was applied in its moral, broader context, as the Ramban describes, to the broader canvas of a relative redeeming a family, redeeming a lineage, redeeming a household, it was called Geula. That's a borrowed term. It's borrowed from the mitzvah of redeeming land, but redeeming land was to redeem the land to its inheritance, to its people. The Geula of the Jewish people is borrowed from the same metaphor. You bring the land, the people of Israel, back to its land. The difference was that it was the woman, in the case of Yibum, the wife, in the case of Geula, the deceased, the widow, in the case of the Jewish people, it is the Jewish nation itself that is the one to initiate the demand to return home. And so Yirmiyahu says to them, Shuvi Bitulat Yisrael, Shuvi El Arayich Eile, return, my daughter of Israel, return to these cities, set signposts, set breadcrumbs, know your way home. You have to take that step home. You are the one who has the moral obligation to fulfill the mitzvah of Geula. It's not waiting for Geula. One of the worst phrases that has completely distorted the whole concept is the notion of waiting for Geula. It's an oxymoron. By definition, we don't wait for Geula. We are Goel. We redeem. It's a verb. You must redeem the land. Don't wait for Geula. The whole concept is backwards. That's Ruth's moment in the field. To say to Boaz, you are my Goel. I am demanding the act of Geula. And from there, the rest of the story unfolds. The only thing we haven't explained, I apologize for going over, I'll stop and I'll take questions. The only thing we haven't explained is how this comes to David HaMelech. And that's really that last piece of the shiur of why this is so relevant to David. Unfortunately, it's not going to be next week. So hopefully I'll figure out with Rabbi Kohman an opportunity to share that last piece of the story. It can really be applied in various contexts outside of Shavuot. And outside of Megillat Ruth, it's really a Tanakh story of the story of David's lineage. And so we'll find that opportunity. But I hope that this has been able to enlighten us a little bit in terms of the nature of Megillat Ruth. I will stop here and I'll be happy to take questions. I apologize for cutting people off in the middle. I just wanted to make sure I got to the end of this unit.
Okay, I think that being here over half a century, over 40 years in Shiloh, I can say for me it's very ironic to listen to you not speaking in this general area, saying that you're not supposed to wait
next year. My plan is to come home next year. So I started there. I'm coming back next year, a year from now.
Okay, when you're ready to go to Shiloh, let me know. Okay. Everyone knows who I am.
I think it's interesting that in discussing the Goel in Ruth, it doesn't mention his name. It's sort of like Midah Keneged Midah. In other words, he did not want to be Mekim et Shem Amet. Therefore, his name is blotted out.
100%. Not only that, I'll go one step further. Go back to the mitzvah of Yibam in the Torah. The stigma of refusing to establish the name of the deceased stigmatizes the name of the brother who refused. And he's now known as Beit Chalutz Hanal. His whole lineage is, right? He didn't want to destroy his lineage. It gets destroyed for him. The stigma of refusing that moral obligation is considered very intense. So it's the same principle that he loses his name. In the Torah, he's referred to as Beit Chalutz Hanal, the one who refused Yibum, whereas now in Megillat Rut, his name is called Ploni Amoni, which is basically a John Doe. Right.
According to the rules of Yerusha, what right does Nomi have to even sell the field to begin with? The field would probably have gone to the Goel regardless, in which case the money would have, the field. The field would have gone to Yerusha to his children rather than having to be Mekim Shem HaMet al Nachalato.
Right. So two things. I don't think it's her field. I think it's his field. I think it's just called her field because she's the widow.
But who, Elimelech?
Elimelech.
Yeah, but Elimelech's Yerusha automatically leaves Naomi's possession and goes to her children, and if not...
Okay, so we're talking about the same Yerusha, the same concept of Yibam, whether it's Naomi or whether it's Machla Mechilion.
I'm saying he wouldn't have had to do Yibam in order to acquire the land because he was the closest living relative.
You're talking about during Yovel?
No. When Elimelech passed away and the sons didn't have any of their own sons, he was the next living relative, and he therefore could have claimed
the land had been sold. The land is in the possession of I don't know, Yanko Beryl down the block. The land was sold.
Then how does she get it back?
Sold the land. The Goel's role is to buy it back. From that moment, it was sold. It was sold. That's Pasha Bahar. Pasha Bahar, Yamuchachicha, if you're impoverished and you can't survive and you have to sell the land. Okay, so the Torah says you sell it to the Ovo. But that's
assumed. Who sold the land? Abimelech?
Probably Abimelech. It says no, me sold it, but I think it means Elimelech. I think they sold it, they abandoned it, unclear. But the land is there waiting for somebody to either buy it back, redeem it. And theoretically, according to the laws of the Torah, assuming they were still being fulfilled in the letter of the law, you could wait till Yovel. But that's not going to help Ruth or anybody else. Unclear when Yovel was practiced. But the land had to be redeemed financially.
Rabbi, I have a question.
Mm.
All lands that were purchased outside of a family, right? Doesn't after 50 years, doesn't it go back to its owner?
That's what I was referring to by the Yovel. So in theory, there is this notion of that by the Yovel that all the land goes back. I'm clear that maybe the Yovel was very far away. Maybe it was a long way off. I'm clear what the... but that's not going to, waiting for Yovel isn't going to help
Naomi, right?
Naomi and Ruth and the family, so that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't it be that they had no idea until Naomi showed up that anyone would ever come back from the family? Yeah. So it was, in a sense, Hefker, and it went back to the family Kupa or the.
Just a family compound. We come back to the Yerusha at some point to the next closest relative. It's unclear. The truth is that it's unclear if it even would. Again, we don't know what the relation is of these relatives. There could be a relation to the wife or sister. We don't necessarily know that they were in line to actually receive the land at Yovel according to the laws of Yovel. Right, the moment you're dealing with Gula, you're talking about a much broader, undefined relation that exists, right? So anybody who could step into that role, again, Yovel is not in the conversation, is not in the equation. Why that's the case can be debated.
Can I ask something? Yeah. I'm really not. It's the first time I really don't understand the whole class today. Are you claiming that the main focus of Megillat Ruth is the Geula? Are you saying that basically, and you're connecting it to the land and not like to Geula of, let's say, the marriage of Boaz and Ruth? And you're basically basing the whole thing on Yechezkel and Yirmiyahu on Geulat Adama?
In reverse.
So explain, because I really am not following.
Then it's in reverse. Well, I'm explaining why the term Geula, as it applies to the mitzvah of Yibum, which is the female initiative to the union with the brother, why that term is used. It's used there, and it's so central there because it's a term that refers to the same lakim shem amet al nachlato on a national scale. And just so in the Torah, the term is used for the gula of land. The Nevi'im used the term for the gula of the people. And in Megillat Rut, it becomes a borrowed term. That's the Ramban's famous observation that Geula in a non-brother context, Yibum in a non-brother context is called Geula because it does the same thing. It returns the land and rehabilitates the family, but it does so with the initiative of the woman, which is why it's always got this stigma attached to it.
Right.
Does that help sort that out?
That connection makes it, I don't know. I looked at it totally different. I'm kind of shocked, but you know, it's okay. Yeah,
that's right. Did Boaz go further than he had to? In other words, he actually marries Rus, correct? Whereas you said in Yibum, you don't marry the person.
Oh.
You only have a relation with her.
Right. Why is that the case? I suspect it's possible that he made it more public, more formal, because he wanted it to be unquestioned. I think it's also possible, and this is Perek Daled we haven't gotten to yet, but the notion of Yibum not requiring a marriage ceremony, I don't know if that's Chazal's initiative or an innovation, or if that's part of the ancient practice of Yibum. I don't know. But what I can tell you, but what I'm pretty confident in saying is that regardless of everything we said today, you still have the stigma of what we said last week. Namely, you still have the Moabite question. And the reason why Ploni Amoni refuses to fulfill the mitzvah of Geula has nothing to do with his lack of desire to fulfill the mitzvah of Geula. It's because he refuses to accept Ruth who is a Moabite. That question is unresolved. That's the central issue in Megillat Ruth.
But that's what Boaz says exactly. That's why doesn't want him. He doesn't want him to get her because he wants to have.
One minute.
He doesn't call Ruta Moabia through the Megillah ever. He calls her Biti, he protects her.
With one exception.
But then at the end, in front of everybody else, he says Ruta Moabia. Why? Because he doesn't want the guy to marry her. Okay. Because he wants to marry her.
Slight different interpretation to Perek Daled. Okay, we can argue.
I also think Perek Gimel is totally different. I think you know what? With that, what you did so beautifully, that you connected it to Lot and to Tamar, then you know, like the beauty is that they did everything clandestine. Everything was hidden. And what does Boaz do? He brings everything, b'shar ha'ir, you know, in public. and yeah, he marries her in Paris.
It's a much more,
so because I see all of Perek Gimel as tikkun for the behavior of Lot and his daughters and Yehuda and Tamar. And that's why David comes out. That's my interpretation of the whole thing. But you know
which
what?
Is totally, which is, I hear that too. I absolutely hear that too. But what I will say about Boaz and Perek Dalet is that the reason Ploni Almoni refuses is because of this issue of her being from Moab. Meaning that issue that we talked about last week, which is the question of her status and the prohibition against Moabites being accepted, and Boaz's willingness to see her chesed and nobody else is on that same page, that's part of the challenge. Boaz says to Ploni Almoni, right, Ruth is a Moabia. Are you willing to take it? And she and are willing to take her. And Ploni Almoni says, no. Pen ashchitet nachalati. Right? Suddenly he's concerned about his lineage because he doesn't accept that Moabite issue. That's what's going on in Perek Dalet. So in Perek Dalet, I think that would explain why Boaz makes it a very public statement, a very public ceremony, to the point that the people have to acknowledge that union, that marriage, by comparing it to Rachel and Leah, by comparing it to Yehuda and Tamar, by giving it a sanction that says, okay, we will accept this legal ruling, because it wasn't just a philosophical ruling, it was a legal ruling that would allow for Ruth as an exception to the rule of a prohibition of Moab. So I think that that's also, whether it was necessary, but that was also part of what he was addressing in that moment.
So are you saying...
I have a question.
Marcy had a question, yeah.
She's
been waiting patiently.
Is she the stress on the Yibum and the Geula? How come when we talk about David's lineage, we don't say David ben, ben Chilion? How come the name of that husband isn't in his lineage?
So that's the machloket Rashi and Ramban, whether the name is referring to a physical name. Do you name the child after the household, or a conceptual one? The Ramban says it doesn't mean you name the child. It means that you've rehabilitated that lineage. You've given it continuation.
When we talk about lineage, we're coming down from
that. We do. But not in terms of yichus, but in terms of the land, in terms of the family legacy, in terms of the spiritual piece of it. And the Rambashi says you name the child after the deceased, right? That there's a name.
Naming the child that was born. But when you talk about...
Yeah. But that's the same machloket.
Ben Machlon or Ben Chilion?
No, but he's not Ben Machlon and Chilion. He's Ben Yishai, who's Ben Oved, who's Ben Boaz, who's Ben Salmon, right? You don't you can't lie about the lineage, right? Well, but the idea
that's the whole point of Yibum.
No. That's why I said that's exactly the debate between the Ramban and the Rashi. Ramban says it's not about the name. It's not about what's on the birth certificate? It's about the concept. It's about the spiritual concept of maintaining that the child is kind of a continuity in persona or spiritual soul, if you will, of the deceased. It gets very esoteric. But I think the concept is the same.
Naomi couldn't have approached Boaz herself and said, listen, you take care of it. You are the goyel. Why did it have to go through such interesting...
Because Yibum is an act of solicitation by the deceased, by the widow, of the goyel. That's how it was done. Mm-hmm. Chazal sanitized it. Chazal, this is Sanhedrin, and they come to before the Sanhedrin. Right? Chazal sanitized it, but in its ancient form, it was a solicitation. That's exactly what it was. It was a solicitation. And it was the only time in which she solicits the husband, the man.
So in ancient times, if there was no marriage and the widow got pregnant from a goel, who would support the widow and the child?
No, it wasn't marriage. The goel married her. But you could have more than one wife. It wasn't about impregnating her. It was about marrying her.
That's
for sure.
Kiddushin, that's the kiddushin.
For sure, it wasn't a one-night stand. That's for sure. It was a moral obligation to provide for the widow and the family, and for sure.
Thank you, Rabbi. The language
of Megillat of Megillat Rut is very powerful. Like Ufrasta Knafecha Lamatecha, right? To spread forth your garment over your maidservants is a very beautiful euphemism for marriage. So concept of a chuppah, right? Not marriage in a legal ceremony sense, but in the sense of there is a we're way over time, but if you just we're just schmoozing, I have a time, so you're welcome. We're off the clock, but
when.
Sfaradim have a custom to wrap the chasukala in the talus.
In the talus,
right? And the idea is also that considered an act
also
of chuppah, right? So a garment is considered an act of intimacy, and therefore it's like chuppah, it's like yichud, right? So that but that comes the same language of ufrasta knafecha lamatecha. To wrap them in a cloak, in a garment, in a cloak or in a garment, I think is the same kind of language.
It's interesting, though, that when they talk about David, they talk about Ruth. They never talk about Machlon and Kilion. So I think the whole thing of Yibum it's more like the connection to Ruth as a model or as a special person than to make a name for Machlon and Kilion. I think that the question that she had about, why aren't they mentioned Machlon and Kilion? I think because they were basically erased and it's Ruth and that's why she's also the hero.
Yeah, I guess the issue is not so much Elimelech, Machlon and Kilion, but the line that they represent, which Moav, which Ruth enters into, she becomes the heir of, so to speak, of that line.
Are you going to tell us when Ruth actually mikayeret? I mean, when?
So
does she...
we talked about that a little bit 2 weeks ago.
On the way.
She has a declaration of loyalty on the way. That's clear in Perikala.
Correct.
But what I tried to describe 2 weeks ago is the fact that conversion in Tanakh times is very different than it is in Chazal times. Chazal had a formality to conversion process because there was already a separation by that point in time between religious life and national life. In biblical context, there was no such separation. So a woman from a non-Jewish lineage, whatever nationality it was, if she came into the land of Israel and she marries an Israelite and she lives in Israel and she lives as an Israelite and she culturally and socially interacts and functions as an Israelite and every bathhouse is a mikveh, essentially that's de facto conversion in the context of Tanakh. Which is why you have so many examples of women from outside marrying Jewish men in the biblical context. You have Shlomo Melech and his political wives, and you have other examples. Hang on a second. There's no formal description ever of a conversion process for women. For men, the only other piece of the equation is that. Right. In the society in which women adopted the practices of their husband, says, right. So if a man is considered part of a different nationality, he may keep his national cultural practice. And so he has to make a public statement of transitioning into an Israelite practice. For that, you had bris mila. And so you had an objective criteria by which that could be determined. By the time Chazal come along, and you to sort of Second Temple period, and you had where Israel was a minority in the land, and you had other nationalities, and now suddenly it was made more sense. You could theoretically formalize that context into what we would call a conversion process. But in Tanakh, if you have an Israelite or non-Israelite marrying an Israelite and living amongst Israelites as a minority, like as somebody living with a Jewish husband in a Jewish home and in a Jewish environment, that was de facto conversion. The only issue with Ruth was because she was a Moabite, that stood in the way of that de facto recognition. Mm-hmm. So Orpah returns to her people and to her God. And Ruth says to Naomi, Amech Ami v'Elokayach Elokai. That's the de facto. That's how it operates. Now I have another problem, which is that she's a Moabite. Can I do that with a Moabite? So that's what we talked about last week in terms of the status of Ruth as a paradigm or a paragon of Chesed, and therefore standing as a opposition, as an example, to the Torah's description of Moab as being anti-Chesed, Sodom-like. But in terms of the formal process of conversion, that's why it was so controversial. The controversy was for generations. David HaMelech, what David describes of himself, that my family is the lowest and least and the most insignificant family in the tribes of Israel. David says of himself when he was asked to become king, to marry the Shaul's mm-hmm. daughters, he says, "Anochi, mi anochi, mi mishpachti, and rash v'nikla, that I'm poor and I'm a low family and I'm insignificant. Why should I become the king, the son-in-law to the king?" Right? But at that point in time, you already see, you feel the impact that Boaz's decision to embrace Ruth had on the family status amongst Israel. It's a source of great controversy, but mm-hmm. that was the greatness of Boaz and the greatness of Ruth.
Okay, thank you.
No problem. All right.
All right.
Wonderful. I hope you enjoyed it. I know that some of you agreed, some of you didn't agree. That's all part of the
work. It was fun, even though I didn't agree. It was fun. Yeah.
No problem.
So we won't have another Shir Erev Shavuot.
No, Erev Shavuot is not another Shir. I have to check with the Rabbi Kelman if we want to sort of run that year as a makeup at some point. I would like to. I'm away for the next 2 weeks after Shavuot. Might pay to do something in line with the before the 3 weeks, because it actually is more of a, it's almost a Tisha B'Av type of shir. It's the story of Beit David and how there's this particular and unique aspect of Yibum that follows the house of David for generations to come. It has to do with the phrase Lakim Shem Amet Al Nachalato. So I want to talk about it. I think it's worthwhile, but we'll have to find a context. I consider it an IOU.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Remember
very
to
much.
Count. Chag Sameach. Chag Sameach.
Yishar koach.
Thank you for the wonderful references.
My pleasure.
Stay thank well. You very much. Thank you. And good day. Thank you.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Chag Sameach.